have taken it with her. Maybe she took her computer, too. A desktop computer? It seems unlikely. But possible. I suppose. You finish looking around in here. I'll check the garage. Ricky scanned the neighborhood through his binoculars. The streets were as quiet and uninteresting as they'd been the other 50 times he'd checked. Country towns, man. Early to bed and early to rise and all that crap. How can anyone live this way? He was a big city boy, an action guy. Bradbury was small-town USA and light on the action. He lowered the glasses and shivered. His perch was on the second story of a house under construction, a couple of blocks from where Ananka and Rosario were. Being on a slight rise, it provided an excellent view of the area. What it did not provide was protection from the quickly descending nighttime temperature. He could not wait until this little foray was completed so he could go somewhere warm. A flash of light to his right drew his attention. A car had turned off the highway into the development. Someone coming home late from work, probably. He raised the binoculars and smiled. Now we're talking. The vehicle was no late-night worker bee cruising home in her hybrid. It was a police sedan. It turned down the first cross street it came to, slow and steady, an officer on his beat. Nice to see Mr. Law doing his job. Ricky followed the sedan as it zigzagged through the neighborhood. When it neared Cloud Drive, he flicked on his comm. Ricky for Ananka. Rosario thumbed through the hanging files in one of the desk drawers. They were in alphabetical order. Bank, gas company, sewage and water, etc. Old school. These days, most people ditched hard copies for digital records in the cloud, if they kept copies at all. She glanced in each file to make sure the contents corresponded to the folder's label. As she closed the drawer, she heard a very subtle thunk. Being a master thief, Rosario recognized the sound right away. She opened the drawer again and pulled it all the way out of the desk. She reached into the vacated space and felt along the underside of the drawer above. Taped against it at the very back was an envelope, with a corner hanging down no more than an inch where the tape holding it had come loose. This flap had caused the noise when she closed the lower drawer. She peeled the envelope free. It was about the length and width of a paperback book, and contained something maybe half an inch thick. She unclasped the flap and tilted the envelope, slid out a small moleskin notebook. What do we have here? She pulled off the elastic band holding the cover in place and opened the notebook. The first 7 pages contained dates, followed by 2 columns. The first column held numbers ranging from 1 to 7, while the second contained 12 character strings of letters and digits. The strings were repeated several times throughout the 7 pages, but never in succession. Beyond these pages, the book was blank. Rosario slipped it into her pocket. If it was important enough to hide, it was important enough for a closer look. She picked up the drawer to slip it back in place as Ricky's voice came over the comm. Though no vehicles currently occupied Patterson's garage, it possessed enough space to house 2 large cars, and that was even taking into consideration the wall of shelves that ran down the far side. Clearly labeled plastic storage bins filled most of the shelf space, while the rest was taken up by items too big or odd in size to fit in a container. Notably, among these loose items were several suitcases. Given Patterson's pattern of keeping things in order, Ananka would have expected to see an empty spot among the bags if the woman had taken one on a trip. But the suitcases took up all their allotted spaces. Right next to them were 2 tubs, one labeled small bags and the other medium bags. She found each was filled to the brim, with no room for anything else. Of course, none of this precluded Patterson from having used a suitcase or bag she'd kept in the house, but Ananka didn't get that sense. Everything had its place, and there had been no obvious storage location inside for a travel bag. If Ananka was right, the logical conclusion was that Patterson had not intended to be gone for any length of time. She headed back toward the door into the house.
Ricky for Ananka.
Go for Ananka.
Hey, boss. Just thought you'd like to know there's a police car heading your way.
I'm not in the mood for jokes, Ricky.
No joke this time.
She paused. How far?
I'd say it'll be turning onto your street in about 15 seconds. So a block away, maybe.
Ananka raced back into the house.
What the hell, Ricky? What happened to a little heads up? Isn't that what I just gave you?
Son of a...
Relax, Ricky said, chuckling. I said he's heading your way, not heading your way. What the hell does that mean? She said, hurrying through the kitchen. He's patrolling the neighborhood, that's all. Nothing to get all freaked out about. She stopped in her tracks. I swear to God, Ricky, one of these days I'm going to drop you down a deep, dark well and walk away.
I will help, Rosario said as she stepped off the stairs onto the first floor.
Got you running, didn't...
Silence.
Ricky?
Ananka said. Another beat passed before he said, We may have a problem.
Define problem.
The cops stopped in front of your house. Both Ananka's and Rosario's gazes shot toward the front, but from where they were, the home's layout provided no direct line of sight to the street. Crouching, they hurried through the dining area into the sunken living room and hunkered down by the sheer curtains covering the front windows. The squad car was parked at the curb, headlights on.
Are you sure we didn't trip an alarm? Ananka asked Rosario.
I am positive.
Ananka stared at the car. If the police had known Patterson was missing, they'd understandably send someone by her house every now and then. But unless the administrator had been misinformed, the police had no idea there was a problem. So why the hell was one of their cars here? The sedan's lights went out, and the driver's door opened.
Oh, crap. I think the cop's getting out, Ricky said.
Yeah, we can see that. Ananka figured if she and Rosario left at that very moment, they had about a 50-50 chance to make it over the rear fence without the officer seeing them. But that would mean not relocking the deadbolt or resetting the alarm, which would be even clearer signs than a tripped monofilament that someone had broken in. The safer play was to stay hidden inside. The officer rounded the front of his car and started walking toward the house. At least, he appeared to be alone. Ananka assumed he would turn down the stone path to the front door, but instead, he headed toward the garage and disappeared from sight.
Go watch the rear, she said to Rosario.
With a nod, Rosario returned to the back of the house.
Ricky, do you still have him? Ananka asked.
Yeah, he's looking at the garage door. Wait, he just crouched down at the west side.
What's he doing?
I can't tell. His back is to me.
A pause.
Okay, he's standing again, heading toward the front.
A light beam streaked across the stone walkway. Ananka lowered herself as far as she could while still being able to see through the window. The officer came into view a moment later, his light turning him into more of a silhouette than before. When he reached the short set of stairs leading up to the small front porch, he squatted and played his beam along the first step. The light bounced off the graystone and illuminated the cop's face, causing Ananka to groan. Not a male cop. Officer Harris. After a few seconds, Harris stood and leaped over the steps onto the porch. Ananka quickly crawled away from the window and moved behind the couch, tucking herself up against it. She half expected to hear a key slip into the lock and the door open, but neither occurred. She heard nothing at all until Ricky said,
Anyone near the front window, hide now.
3 seconds later, a light shined inside and swept through the living room. Ananka pressed against the sofa and watched the beam cut back and forth several times before disappearing.
Status, she whispered.
He's off the porch, Ricky reported.
Not a he, Ricky.
What? Really? Well, she's heading around the right side of the house. Hold on, she's opening the backyard gate. I'm going to lose her in a second.
Ananka hurried to the rear of the house and joined Rosario. From their hidden spot, they could see the deck and the grass area near the back fence. The flashlight beam shot through the yard a moment before Harris walked into view. The cop played her light over the grass and approached the deck. When she reached the steps, she did the same thing she'd done out front, crouched and studied them.
Son of a bitch! The monofilaments! Harris was checking them!
Ananka was willing to bet another set had been strung across the front porch steps, and probably a third attached to the garage door. Either Harris had put them there, or she worked with whoever had. Not the police department, though. Stringing monofilaments was not standard policy for even the most advanced forces, so there was no way little old Bradbury's department would employ such methods. Besides, if they thought Patterson was missing, they'd be a lot more overt in their efforts to find her. A rogue officer involved in the woman's disappearance made much better sense. If Ananka had been that person, she would have wanted to know if anyone was snooping around her victim's house. Of course, Ananka would have used much more sophisticated methods, such as cameras and hidden microphones.
Officer Harris, you have moved to the very top of my persons of interest list.
When the officer stood back up, she shined her flashlight across the deck. Apparently satisfied, she went back the way she'd come and disappeared. As soon as Ricky announced she had driven off, Ananka and Rosario left. After they arrived back at the hotel, Rosario showed Ananka the notebook she'd found. Ananka looked over the chart on the first several pages. Maybe the right column is a personal code for a particular event or action, and the left one is how many times that action occurred?
That is as good a guess as any. If you give me a little more time, I can try to figure it out.
Ananka handed the book back with a nod. Patterson's computer first. That's priority. Then the book. Better yet, shoot some pictures of it and send it off to Shinji. I'm sure he's dying for something to do. While Rosario set to work, Ananka grabbed her own computer to write up a list of what they knew so far and see if that would spur some other ideas. As the machine was booting up, Ricky called.
I'm back, he said. What's next?
Nothing else tonight. Get some rest.
It's barely 11 p.m. There must be something.
Go to sleep, Ricky.
Why would I...
She hung up.
Just so you know, I checked the kit, and there is more than enough sedative to keep him unconscious for the whole job, Rosario said.
Don't tempt me. Though Ricky had been granted his release from Crestridge Federal Prison when he agreed to join the administrator's team, he wasn't exactly free. Granted, detention on the Charis Ivanis was considerably better than his days at Crestridge. On the ship, there was a video arcade, satellite TV, a private deck for lounging around, and a kitchen that served food a million times better than the crap the feds gave him. But he was still in confinement. He couldn't even try to sneak off the boat. His new employers had injected him with subdermal tracking bugs that allowed them to always know exactly where he was. Anytime he came within a couple dozen feet of the gangplank, one of the ship's security personnel would appear to remind him it would be healthier to find somewhere else to loiter. Now that he was off the ship on another mission, there was no way he would go to sleep yet. He was sure Ananka would be fine with him going out for a bit, but to be safe, he walked the motorcycle a block from the hotel before firing up its distinctive motor. With the chilly wind rushing past him, he drove to a place he'd seen called the Blue River Bar, not far from the Brazen Diner. Though the sign had been turned off, he didn't give it much thought until he walked up to the door and found it locked.
Are you kidding me?
Did the state of Washington have some sort of draconian law about alcohol serving time? That didn't seem possible. Not in the 21st century. He figured the bar hadn't been busy enough to stay open tonight. What else could it be?
Their loss.
Bradbury might be small, but it wasn't that small. Surely someplace else would still be open. And come on, was Ricky supposed to believe that a town with a sizable community of tech nerds didn't have, at the very least, a fancy cocktail place that served into the wee hours? He googled bars near me, then gawked at the results. Within 25 miles of where he was, there were only 5 entries. At the top of the list was Blue River. Weekday hours, 11 a.m. to 10:30 p.m. What a waste of real estate. Another place, Max's, was also closed. It was more a bar and grill, off the highway just south of town. Of the 3 bars supposedly still open, only 2 were within city limits. The Bradbury Brewery and the Cash Bar. Ricky could imagine the decor of the latter. Motherboards and floppy disks hanging from the ceiling, and portraits of Bill Gates and Steve Jobs on the walls. Definitely a location of last resort. The Bradbury Brewery it was. He found the place on the east side in an old converted barn. A handful of cars sat in the lot, and the light still blazed inside. Feeling a sense of sweet relief, Ricky parked his bike as close to the entrance as he could and sauntered inside. 3 rows of picnic tables filled half the space. The other half was cut off by a serving bar running across the room, behind which lived the metal tanks and other accoutrements of the brewing business. It was a surprisingly large operation, making Ricky think they were likely selling beer up and down the river. Probably even had visions of breaking out nationwide. 3 hipster types manned the bar. A guy with a substantial beard and shaved head, and 2 girls sporting tattoo-sleeved arms. Spread out among the tables were several groups, most made up of 20 and 30-somethings. Scattered among them were gatherings of slightly older folks sharing a beer and a laugh.
Evening, the female bartender with the darker hair said as Ricky approached. What can I get you?
Evening to you too, he said, flashing his Ricky grin. Let me see.
He examined the beer list hanging behind her.
Stouts, lagers, a double IPA, a Hefeweizen, even a Belgian farmhouse. As impressive as the list was, its abundance of styles made him pause. Brewing was an art, each variety taking time to perfect. He questioned if this place had been in business long enough to create acceptable versions of all they were selling.
Can I get a taster of the Hef?
Of course. She bopped over to the taps, poured a little of the wheat beer into a small glass, and escorted it back.
Not bad, he said after a sip.
It was not the best ever, but better than he'd expected.
I'll take a pint.
She poured him a glass, and he paid with a 10, telling her to keep the change. That earned him a playful look that, were he not on the job, he'd have been tempted to investigate later. Being about as far from an introvert as one could possibly get, Ricky took a seat between a group of youngsters and a couple of guys probably in their early 40s, in hopes of working his way into one of the conversations. The two guys were the first to look over when he plopped down. He raised his glass, but they didn't take the cue and returned to whatever it was they were talking about.
To hell with you too, Ricky thought as he took a drink.
He turned his attention to the others, but they didn't seem to notice him at all.
Fine, whatever. At least I'm out enjoying a beer and... I don't care,
one of the older guys who'd blown off Ricky said, his voice suddenly loud.
Relax, his friend whispered harshly.
Ricky listened in.
I can't do this again, the first guy said.
We have an obligation.
You do it then, I'm done. You can't just back out. You know they're not going to like that. Watch me.
The I'm done guy drained his glass and stood up.
Let's get out of here.
His friend rose and they walked out. Small town drama. A couple of aging computer geeks tired of pretending to be Nigerian princes, maybe. When he snickered, one of the 20-somethings looked over. Ricky smiled and said,
Any of you know a good place in this town to get a decent breakfast?
Food, the ultimate conversation starter. Ricky and his new friends talked until closing, and by the time he laid his head on his pillow, he had almost, but not quite, forgotten about the I'm done guy and his friend. 10. The next morning, New York City to Washington State. Dylan found Liesl already waiting at the JFK Airport departure gate for their flight to Seattle. It had been only a few days since the team was last together, but he was still happy to see her. Though he didn't want to admit it, working with the others probably meant more to him than any of them. As a driver, courier for hire, he conducted the majority of his work alone. It was nice to be part of a group he could count on. And even though they hadn't spent that much time together, he liked everyone. Well, the jury was still out on Ricky, but Dylan could tolerate him well enough.
How was home? He asked Liesl after a hug.
Quiet, she said in her brevity of words way.
How was Dublin?
Excellent, thanks. Dropped in on my family and surprised them.
He patted his stomach.
Ate too much, I think.
On the plane, they sat together near the front. Liesl spent much of the flight sleeping while Dylan watched a replay of an old Champions League football match on the tiny TV mounted in front of him. In Seattle, they boarded a smaller plane for the flight east to Spokane. Upon arrival, they found their promised sedan waiting in the parking lot. In one of the bags in the trunk, they found their mission information packets, which included identifications for one Carl Line, American citizen originally from Cork, Ireland, and Andrea Krauss, a Swiss national. The biographies explained that Andrea, a novelist, was on a research trip to the Pacific Northwest for her next book, and Line, the publisher's representative, was assisting her. The other bags contained tools of the trade.
Perhaps I should sit in the back, Liesl said.
Why? I am not sure Andrea Krauss is the kind of person to sit next to the help.
She reached for the back door.
Don't you dare open that, Dylan said. You're up front with me.
She allowed herself a small grin.
I suppose Andrea might make an exception this time.
Your kindness knows no bounds.
During the drive to Bradbury, Liesl read aloud from the mission brief so that Dylan would be as up-to-date as she was. When she finished, he said,
Missing woman that no one realizes is missing? Even money she ran off with a lover.
Liesl looked back through the pages.
There is no mention of a lover.
Oh, sweet innocent Liesl, there's always a lover.
You are incorrect. I do not have a lover, and neither do you.
And how would you be knowing that?
She looked him up and down.
I know.
The fact she was right and was so sure about it annoyed him. 60 miles from Bradbury, traffic slowed to a crawl, and not long after that it stopped. Dylan angled the sedan to see around the RV two vehicles in front of him, but all this revealed was the crest of a hill 100 yards ahead, and more cars. 5 minutes passed with no movement on their side and no cars coming from the other direction.
I'll be right back, Dylan said and opened his door.
Where are you going? To see if I can figure out what's going on.
Do me a favor, if things start moving again before I get back, get behind the wheel and drive for a bit.
He hopped out before she could say no and started up the slope. His hike apparently signaled to other drivers it was okay for them to do the same. Before Dylan reached the top of the hill, 6 people were following him. After cresting the summit and seeing the road ahead, he cursed under his breath. The line of motionless vehicles stretched down the other side of the hill and into a large grove of pines. About 1/4 mile farther on, among the trees, a dying pillar of smoke rose into the sky. If it had been a forest fire, the fire department had done a bang-up job of putting it out before it spread. More likely, it had been a car. A few minutes later, as the last of the smoke dissipated, cars in the opposite lane began moving out of the woods. Dylan counted 20 of them before the trickle stopped, and the vehicles in his lane nearest the trees started inching forward. The authorities were letting traffic through in alternating groups. Dylan was back in the driver's seat in plenty of time to join the slow progress toward the woods. It took almost 20 minutes for Liesl and him to reach the front of the line. As they waited for the 20 cars coming from the other direction to pass, Dylan got his first good look at the problem. Not a car fire, but a truck. A big rig with a cargo trailer hitched to the back. The fire had consumed both trailer and tractor, collapsing the trailer into blackened slag and turning the truck's cab into a charred ghost of its former self. There were 4 fire engines, 5 state police cruisers, and 2 ambulances parked nearby. Since the ambulances were still there, Dylan guessed whoever they'd been intended to transport had either gotten out in time or were beyond help. Death by fire. Dylan cringed. He'd take losing his life by freezing over fire any day of the week. He'd take almost anything over fire, except maybe drowning. Even then it would be a close call. When they were finally allowed to drive on, he mouthed a prayer for the potentially departed and then increased speed. Less than an hour later, they were in Bradbury. Ananka and Rosario were in Ananka's room, both on their computers, when Liesl called and let them know she and Dylan had arrived. The administrator had arranged for the novelist and her assistant to stay in a rental house with a view of the river, 2 miles from the hotel. Liesl reported there was a back way onto the property that would allow the others to visit without anyone in the area seeing them. "We'll be right over," Ananka said. Before leaving, she called Ricky.
What?
He said.
"Are you still asleep?"
"Oh, hey, babe. Ananka? I was just, lounging."
"You were sleeping."
I might have dozed off, but what does it matter? It's not like you've given me anything to do.
"Well, I'm giving you something now." She relayed the instructions on how to get to Liesl and Dylan's house. "Be there in 20, and bring drinks."
"Beer?"
"Water, fruit juice, maybe some iced tea."
"That doesn't sound like fun."
"It's not supposed to be fun, Ricky. Get moving." She hung up. The rental house sat on a large lot in an area of other large homes on large lots, spread across a bluff overlooking the Columbia River. As instructed, Ananka and Rosario parked inside a work shed on the adjoining property. A path through the bushes led them to a hidden gate that opened into a trellis-covered passageway, which took them to the back deck of the house.
"Welcome to Casa de Artista," Dylan said, standing in the threshold of an open sliding glass door.
The women greeted him with hugs and then did the same with Liesl, who was standing just inside.
"Smooth journey?" Ananka asked.
"No problems for me," Dylan replied.
"Same," Liesl said.
"What do you mean, Casa de Artista?"
Rosario asked. Dylan pointed at the living room wall where old metal letters had been mounted spelling out the phrase.
"There's a lot of art on the walls, too. Seems to be a theme."
He paused before adding,
"Some of it's not that good, to be honest."
They sat around the large dining table, and Ananka and Rosario began bringing the other two up to speed. They had just finished describing their nighttime visit to Natasha Patterson's home when a buzzer sounded.
"The back gate is wired," Liesl explained. "Ricky must be here."
A few moments later, they heard steps on the back deck.
Dylan pulled open the door, and in walked Ricky carrying an overstuffed cloth shopping bag.
"Morning, gang," Ricky said. "Cool clubhouse."
He walked over to the table and set the bag down.
"I've got drinks."
"Put them all in the refrigerator," Ananka said.
"Bad enough I had to lug all this over on my motorcycle, and now you're going to make me put it away, too?"
"Ricky, again, not complaining, just making an observation." He carried the bag into the kitchen.
"Were you able to figure out the columns in the notebook?" Liesl asked, refocusing the conversation on where Ananka and Rosario had left off.
"Shinji's still working on that," Ananka said.
"What about her computer?" Dylan asked.
"That we do know," Rosario said. "She had a top-of-the-line Dell Inspiron. That means monitor and tower."
"Not something you'd likely take with you on a whim," Ananka said. Ricky strolled back into the room.
"So, what are we talking about?"
He took a sip from the can he was carrying.
"What is that?" Ananka asked.
"Margarita in a can."
"You're drinking?"
He looked at her as if she were talking crazy.
"Of course I'm drinking. I'm thirsty."
"Are you serious?"
"Hold on there, boss."
He turned the can toward her and tapped the label. "Non-alcoholic." Dylan looked as if he was going to be sick.
"That sounds even worse."
"Anybody else want one? I got a six-pack."
Ananka took a deep breath.
"Just sit."
"All right, you can serve yourselves."
Ricky took the empty chair next to Liesl.
"Hey, sunshine."
"My name is Liesl."
"Isn't that what I said?"
Ananka finished describing the rest of what they'd been doing, then said, "There are a ton of outstanding questions. What I'm hoping is that we can answer a lot of them today. Schedule-wise, Rosario and I have the mixer this evening that the city's sponsoring. My understanding is that there should be some important people in attendance, including Natasha's boss, Kyle Scudder."
"Ooh, that sounds like fun," Ricky said. "Maybe it would be a good idea to have another pair of eyes there."
"Exactly what I was thinking." Ricky leaned back, smiling smugly. "I'll talk to the administrator," Ananka said. "See if he can arrange for Liesl and Dylan to be invited." Ricky went from self-satisfied to put out in a second flat.
"Wait, what?"
"They have a good backstory. No one will question their presence."
But I don't have a backstory. Just a stupid alias. Rudy Schmidt."
"Which makes you more flexible."
"All right. Good. Flexible isn't bad. What am I supposed to do while you are all having fun?"
"What you do best. Hunt. I need you out there looking for Patterson or anything unusual. In fact, that goes for everyone. Keep your eyes and ears open for anything weird in case there actually is something larger going on here."
"Do we have any new intel on Patterson?"
Ricky asked. "Rosario has created a map of her cell trail on the night she disappeared. I want you to check everywhere she went."
"You mean I get to ride around again?"
"You get to ride around again."
"See? If you'd told me that from the beginning, I'd have been fine."
"I will send you the information," Rosario said.
"Thank you, darling."
"Ricky," Ananka said.
"What? Oh, thank you, Rosie."
"Ricky!" He took a breath.
"Thank you, Rosario. Man, you guys are so uptight sometimes."
"So are we to just wait around until the party?" Dylan asked.
"I've got something to keep you busy, too," Ananka said. "Skolarian gives tours every afternoon at 1. You two are supposed to be here doing research. Go research." 11. The big rig's engine whined as it downshifted, sending a jolt through the trailer that earned cries of surprise from several of its occupants. Eduardo felt Sonia stiffen as she jerked awake.
"It's okay," he whispered.
A few moments passed before he felt her relax.
"Are we stopping?"
she asked. She had told him she was 18, which would make her 2 years his junior, but he suspected she was younger than that.
"I think so."
They'd been inside the metal box for 2 days and had stopped several times, but never for long, and not once had the back door opened. Eduardo didn't know how he got inside the trailer, but he recalled the events leading up to it. Jobs had been hard to come by as of late, and he'd taken to joining the day workers that hung out at the parking lot entrance to the Home Depot. A guy in a pickup had come looking for help clearing junk from a property and had picked Eduardo out of the crowd. As they drove off, the guy, he introduced himself as Mr. King, asked Eduardo about his day,
about the type of work he'd been getting, about where he liked to eat. They talked about family, too. Mr. King saying Eduardo was lucky he hadn't started one yet, that all his possibilities were still open. Then Mr. King asked if Eduardo was thirsty, and nodded at the small chest between them, telling Eduardo to grab a bottle of water. It had been a warm morning, and he'd been standing around for hours, so Eduardo took a deep drink. He remembered feeling dizzy, but nothing after that, until he woke here. There were five others with him, three men and two women. They'd been locked inside with three large ice chests that had been full of food and water when they started out, but were now getting close to empty. Against the wall was a chemical toilet booth, like ones at construction sites where Eduardo had worked. It probably stank to high heaven, but he couldn't tell anymore. He hadn't known any of the others when he'd woken to find himself here. There had been a little talking at first, but no one knew where they were going, only that it couldn't be anywhere good. After that, most kept to themselves. When Eduardo heard Sonia crying that first night, he'd gone to her and held her and told her everything would be all right.
"What time is it?"
she asked now. "Not sure." The inside of the trailer was pitch dark, though from the warmth radiating off the metal side he was propped up against, it must have been daytime. "Are you thirsty?"
"No, I'm okay."
He uncapped his water bottle and moved it to where he thought her hands were. "Take a little. You need to keep drinking." A beat, then,
"Okay."
He held on to the bottle until he was sure she had control of it, then he leaned back. After she took a sip, she asked for the millionth time,
"Where do you think they're taking us?"
And for the millionth time, he said, "I don't know." The truck continued to slow. When it finally stopped, Eduardo could hear voices outside. He wanted to scream and pound on the walls in hopes of getting help, but a voice over a speaker had warned them early on if they did anything to draw attention to the truck, the punishment would be severe and shared by all. A few moments later, he heard the clink of a nozzle being put into a fuel tank. Wherever they were headed, they apparently still had a ways to go. 12. Using Rosario's map, Ricky started his hunt at the entrance to Patterson's housing tract and headed north out of town. Most of the data indicated she'd made steady progress all the way to the bridge. There was, however, an area about 30 miles past Bradbury where Patterson had remained within the confines of a single-cell town for nearly an hour. Could be she was visiting a friend or having dinner at a cafe. Whatever the case, it was Ricky's job to figure it out. Upon entering the zone in question, he slowed but did not stop until he reached the far end of the tower's range. No cafes or businesses or anything of that nature. Not along the main highway, anyway. There were several roads leading away from the highway, four along the west side and seven along the east. Of these, only five were paved. Ricky grinned. Options made a hunt fun. Heading back the way he'd come, he turned down the first road on his right, one of the dirt ones. Scattered along it were a few homes set within the trees. Ricky stopped just long enough near each driveway to snag a quick stealth picture of its mailbox, as all had addresses on them and most had names, too. Rosario could cross-check them against people who they knew had interacted with Patterson. The next right turn off the highway, another dirt road, was a private driveway. He snapped another mailbox photo and moved on. After exploring a few more streets, he had yet to come across a single business and was beginning to think Patterson must have stopped at a house. It was the easiest explanation for why she'd remained in the area so long. The next dirt road, on the east side, started off as more of the same, but soon he realized it was longer than the others. As he neared what he guessed was the outer edge of the cell tower's reach, he spotted another dirt road heading north into the woods. It was wider than the other driveways and had no mailbox standing sentry at the end. He turned onto it, but kept his speed down so that the engine was only a low rumble. The route curled through the woods, right and left and right again. He came around this last bend and let the bike roll to a stop. A guard shack with an attached gate blocked the road 30 feet ahead. Standing just outside the shack was a man in a security uniform, his hand dangling very close to the pistol on his belt. Ricky smiled broadly and said,
"Howdy!"
Not moving, and definitely not smiling, the guard shouted back,
"Sir, you're going to have to turn around and go back the other way. This is private property." "What? You need to turn—" Hold on, I can't hear you."
Ricky revved the bike and glided it forward. The guard tensed, his hand touching his weapon now. Ricky stopped several feet away.
"Sorry about that." He gestured toward his ears. "Too many rock concerts, know what I mean?"
He let out a laugh. Now, what did you say? This is private property. You need to turn around and leave.
Really?
Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? I was wondering where the hell I was. My buddy Xander, he's terrible at giving directions. You wouldn't happen to know where I'd find the back road to Harmony Creek, would you?
No idea. You need to leave now, sir.
Bummer. Well, it was worth the ask.
Ricky craned his neck and looked past the guard, as if there was something to see. There wasn't.
Some rich guy lived back there?
Sir, I'm not going to ask you again.
All right, I'm out of here. No need to get all Gestapo on me.
Ricky wheeled his bike around. Before taking off, he looked back and said,
For someone who gets to sit in a beautiful place like this, you're awfully uptight.
He hit the gas and headed back the other way. When he reached the main dirt road, he took it until he was sure he'd gone far enough for the guard not to hear his bike anymore. He made a U-turn and drove back toward the turnoff as far as he thought he could without being detected. He turned off the engine and maneuvered the bike back into the trees where it wouldn't be seen by anyone driving by. He left his helmet on the seat and set off through the woods toward the guarded property. In addition to the guard's aggression, Ricky had noticed something else that was odd. The guardhouse hadn't been built on a permanent foundation, but sat on a leveled pad of dirt. Fresh dirt, that is. As a hunter, Ricky was trained to pick out those kinds of details, and the dirt hadn't looked weathered enough to have been exposed to open air for more than a week or two, which meant the guardhouse had likely been erected after Patterson disappeared. This led Ricky wondering if the two events were connected, which in turn led to a desire for a covert look around. Once he caught sight of the guardhouse, he used his phone's camera to zoom past the trees and see through the side window. Mr. Aggressive was sitting in a chair watching television. There were at least two monitors. The angle allowed Ricky to see only the screen of one and a sliver of a second. On the monitor he could see was a view of the intersection where the guarded road met the main dirt road. No wonder the asshole had been waiting outside his hut when Ricky turned the corner. Ricky moved through the woods, past the guard shack, all the way to where the trees stopped. Using a trunk as cover, he peered into the meadow beyond. About 5 yards away stood a fence that encircled the entire clearing. The cordoned-off area enclosed a construction site. Ricky could see the topsoil had been removed and the exposed dirt had been leveled off. The cleared area was easily 3 football fields wide. Dotting this field in parallel lines were round concrete pillars, sticking maybe 1.5 feet out of the ground. Each pillar had a metal bracket secured to the top. Ricky had no idea what kind of building was being constructed. It certainly didn't look like the start of any he'd ever seen before. Call him crazy, but it appeared the structure would be supported on the pillars, like in a flood zone. Only this couldn't be a floodplain. If the Columbia ever rose this high, the whole planet would be screwed. A rectangular building sat on the other side of the fence, about 24 yards to Ricky's right. It was one of those mobile home-type offices used on construction sites. Like the rest of the site, it appeared to be deserted. Not surprising, given it was a Saturday. Check that. Almost deserted. A golf cart moved from behind a stack of building materials at the far side of the meadow and continued slowly along the interior of the fence. Ricky used his phone's camera again to get a better look. Even with the zoom, the cart was too far away for him to make out much, but Ricky had no doubt the driver was wearing a uniform identical to that of the guard at the gate. Ricky conducted a more thorough camera scan of the site, checking for other guards, but it appeared there were only the two men. He lowered his phone. So, was this where Patterson had stopped? Though whatever was being built here looked unusual, the construction site didn't seem particularly nefarious. He crept as close as he dared to the fence and looked for anything that might indicate who owned the site. But there wasn't even a no trespassing sign hanging on the chain link. Stymied, he turned back to the woods, but went only a few steps before an idea hit him. He looked back and swore under his breath.
Jesus, Ricky, you're losing your touch.
What would one do with a large open field filled with rows and rows of stubby pillars topped with brackets? Mount something on them. What company did Patterson work for? Scalarian. And what business was Scalarian in? Solar power. What Ricky was looking at had to be the beginnings of a solar energy collection farm. He should have realized that right off. And if this was Scalarian's property, then the chances Patterson had come there just skyrocketed to 99%.
Okay, but why?
Patterson was the company's CFO, so it seemed unlikely she was inspecting the construction. The site's plans and papers and that kind of stuff, though, that might fall under her responsibility. And where would that stuff be kept? Inside the trailer. Or she could have come here to meet someone, Ananka's voice said in his head. Why was it always her voice that came up with the good ideas? Okay, either meet someone or check something in the trailer. What if it was both? Perhaps she met someone and together they did something in the trailer. Maybe she was having an affair and it had been discovered and... Slow down there, champ, he whispered. His imagination was getting a little too wild. The trailer was the important thing. Something inside might help them find Patterson. As much as he wanted to hop the fence and break in, there was way too much daylight. Better if done under the cover of dark, and with someone watching his back. He returned to his bike and phoned Ananka. When she didn't answer, he called Rosario.
Where's the boss?
He asked. Busy. Did you find anything?
Ricky always finds something.
Liesl and Dylan arrived at Scholarian 15 minutes prior to the advertised tour start time. The receptionist directed them to a corner of the large lobby where three others, a man and two women, all over 70, waited.
Taking the tour, too? The man asked.
That we are,
Dylan said. The man's eyes lit up.
Irish?
I am.
Me, too. My grandfather came over from Dublin around the turn of the century.
Is that so? Dylan said.
This was by no means his first trip to the States, and he'd come to realize almost everyone here believed they were Irish to some extent.
I love Ireland, one of the women said. Spent a wonderful 3 days in Cork.
She turned to the other lady.
When was that?
After a short pause, the other woman said,
95. No, 94. Right, 94. Just lovely.
I'm partial to it myself, Dylan said.
Are you here on vacation?
Dylan was saved from reciting his made-up backstory by the arrival of a smiling man in his early 20s, clad in khakis and a tucked-in light green polo shirt, with Scholarian embroidered over his right breast.
Good afternoon, he said. My name is Casey, and I'll be your tour guide today. How is everyone doing?
Not surprisingly, everyone was doing fine.
A couple of business items, and then we'll get started. The tour will last approximately 45 minutes, and will take in our production, testing, and distribution facilities. Depending on what's being worked on when we go through, there may be some areas that we will not be able to enter. If you have questions as we go along, please don't hesitate to ask. And one final note, please, no photography.
Well, that sucks, one of the women grumbled.
The guide pretended not to hear, said,
Follow me, please,
then led them across the lobby and through a set of double doors at the far end. As Dylan held one of the doors open for the others to pass through, he tapped a finger against the pocket of his pants, depressing the remote switch that activated a micro camera concealed in the messenger bag he carried. Now everywhere they went would be recorded on high-definition video. Their first stop was a conference room, where the walls were decorated with pictures of Kyle Scudder shaking hands with or standing next to celebrities and politicians. Prominent among the latter group were pictures of him with each of the last three U.S. presidents, two U.K. prime ministers, a long-serving prime minister of Germany, and the Chinese premier. There were also certificates and proclamations that had been bestowed either on Scudder or the company.
Scholarian was founded 23 years ago, right after Kyle Scudder graduated from MIT,
Casey informed them.
What began as a consulting firm focused on alternative energy eventually evolved into one of the prime players in the solar energy field.
Casey went into a detailed history of how Scudder's firm grew and moved west, first to Seattle and then here to Bradbury.
Scholarian has been at the forefront of advances in solar technology over the past decade, and with the introduction last year of the Scholarian roof tiles, we continue to lead the way into the future.
Dylan couldn't help himself. He raised a hand and said,
Didn't Elon Musk's people come up with that idea?
Casey's smile tightened.
A common misperception. It was actually Kyle Scudder, long before Mr. Musk mentioned the subject.
Is that so? Didn't know that.
Now, if you'll follow me, we'll visit the production facility.
Casey seemed eager to get moving again, which made Dylan think there was more than a smidgen of bullshit to the guide's answer. Not being allowed within the production facility itself, the tour group observed the hangar-sized room from an elevated glassed-in walkway. Below, a combination of machines and humans
worked to create the roof tiles that would both collect the sun's energy and act as a barrier against the weather. The human workers all wore white jumpsuits and matching hoods that covered their hair. The get-ups reminded Dylan of pictures he'd seen of computer chip manufacturing facilities, or of Breaking Bad. He stifled a laugh at the idea of the space below being one giant meth lab. Liesl elbowed him.
Sorry, he whispered.
As Casey droned on, describing what was happening on the production floor, Liesl jabbed Dylan again.
What?
He said under his breath. This time, when he looked at her, she glanced toward the ceiling of the hangar. He followed her gaze. Crisscrossing just below the ceiling was a series of catwalks. Above these, spread across the roof itself, were four man-sized hatches. Dylan casually adjusted the strap of his bag so that the camera could record it all. A few minutes later, Casey escorted the tour group down a set of stairs into the testing area, a space about a quarter the size of the production room. It had been divvied up into several work areas, some of which were blocked off by large portable dividers, keeping whatever was being worked on out of sight.
This is where we create the future, Casey explained. Our research scientists are tasked with thinking about what alternative energy will look like in 20 years and 30 and even 50. In this way, Scholarian will secure its place as a continuing leader in the industry.
He went on to spin more corporate PR without really saying anything specific about the latest products. When Casey finished his "Look how great we are" speech, he led everyone outside to a couple of waiting golf carts. Behind the wheel of each was a driver dressed in khakis and a company shirt that matched the guide's.
"Please, everyone, hop on one of the vehicles and we'll head over to our East Building," Casey said.
The older folks filled one, and Dylan, Liesl, and Casey hopped on the other. As the cart circled around the back of the manufacturing building, they passed through a small parking area filled with high-end cars in spots that had placards identifying who parked where. Dylan turned the camera and recorded the license plates and placards. The real payoff came as they went by the spot nearest the door into the building. The sign in front of it read, "Kyle Scudder." Parked in his spot was a silky black Lexus GS hybrid. $65,000 just for the base model. Nice to be the boss. The carts wove through the main parking area and across the highway into the lot in front of the Scholarian building on the east side. It was a mirror image of the building they'd just toured. The inside, however, had been designed to serve as the company's product storage, packing, and shipping center. Nothing much of interest, as far as Dylan could see, though there was one little nugget that came to light as they were leaving when the old man said,
"You make the shingles over there,"
and pointed across the highway.
"We refer to them as tiles," Casey corrected him with a smile. "Tiles, sorry. You make them there, and you haul them across the highway over here to ship? Why didn't you just build a bigger building over there? Or at least put the two buildings next to each other?" "I see you're bucking for a position on our board of directors," Casey said, reciting what sounded like a line he'd used a lot. In truth, that was the plan, but we were unable to secure enough property on either side of the road. But let me correct one misperception. We don't haul the tiles across the highway. There's a tunnel that links the two buildings, and an automated conveyor system that moves them from one building to the other. That bit of knowledge was worth the previous 15 minutes of tedium. At the end of the tour, Casey gave each of them a 2-inch square piece of roof tile, a refrigerator magnet that said Scholarian, Star Powered, and a brochure for the company that included a coupon for 10% off solar installation. He then guided them into a small but well-stocked gift shop. While the older crowd perused the wares, Dylan and Liesl made their way back to their car. After the planning meeting at Casa de Artista, Ananka transferred into her backpack several items from one of the bag of tricks that had been in Liesl and Dylan's car, then drove Rosario to the hotel. "I should be back in an hour or so," she said before her friend climbed out of the Mustang. "Text me if anything important comes up." "Of course." Once Rosario was gone, Ananka headed into the center of town and parked a block from the police station. Before starting in on the task that had brought her there, she called the administrator.
"Any progress?"
he asked.
"We haven't found her yet, if that's what you're hoping, but it does look like you were right to be concerned. I don't think Patterson's off on some kind of self-discovery vacation."
She briefed him on their investigation so far.
Do you think this cop is involved?
Unsure, but we're looking into her.
What about Scudder?
I'm hoping to meet him tonight. The Bradbury Business Association is throwing a mixer this evening for me. He and a lot of other local bigwigs are supposed to be there.
I know. Who do you think put that idea into their head?
Good, then you can definitely help me out.
What do you need?
Rosario's coming to the party with me, but it would be great if you could pull a few strings and get Liesl and Dylan invited too. The more eyes and ears, the better.
Easily done. I'll text you with confirmation as soon as I have it. Anything else?
That's it for now. After hanging up, Ananka grabbed her backpack off the rear seat and set it on her lap. Inside were the rectangular plastic cases she'd taken from the gear bag. They were nearly identical, about an inch high by an inch wide by four long. Each contained a different type of bug, tracking, listening, combo. There were also variations on adhesion, sticky back, magnetic, none. A two-letter code etched into the lid on each box indicated which kind was inside. Ananka removed several easy-follow tracking bugs with sticky backs from their container and climbed out of her car. The city of Bradbury had obviously been undergoing rapid expansion due to the tech industry invasion. Some parts had been handled more successfully than others. An example of the latter was the police station. The building that served as the department's headquarters might have been fine back when Bradbury had been a sleepy river town, but it was clearly too small for the city's current needs. Three temporary buildings that looked not so temporary anymore had been erected in the parking lot, leaving only a handful of spaces, all of which were filled with squad cars. Several more police vehicles were parked along the street, and the nearby spaces they weren't using were filled with other vehicles that Ananka guessed belonged to departmental employees. She strolled down the sidewalk like a person with somewhere to go but in no hurry to get there. She moved her gaze casually through the neighborhood, the way one would while walking down a street. In reality, Ananka took in everything. The satellite dishes on top of the temporary buildings, the three men who'd just entered the diner across the street, and the pair of police station cameras, one above the front entrance and the other watching over the parking lot. The one covering the lot was clearly a relic from a pre-tech boom era, much of its view now blocked by one of the satellite dishes. There was no one in the truncated parking lot, nor did she see anyone looking out any of the small windows on the temp structures. Seizing the opportunity, she veered into the lot as she pulled out four tracking chips, removed the plastic covering the sticky back from one of them, and adhered the chip under the apex of the back wheel well of the first cruiser she passed. A glance around confirmed she was still alone, so she moved to the next vehicle and repeated the trick. In less than a minute, she had all four cars in the lot bugged. It was, perhaps, overkill. The only car she was really interested in was the one Officer Harris would be using, but Ananka was covering her bases. Of course, knowing where the rest of the force was at any given moment could turn out to be a nice side benefit. The three squad cars parked in front of the station were trickier. Too many directions someone could see her from, and weaving around the trio of vehicles might provoke curiosity. She did her walk-by-wheel-well trick on the nearest car, but instead of continuing to the next one, she headed across the street and went into the pharmacy on the corner. There she purchased toothpaste and shampoo, and then crossed back to the station side of the street. This time she walked down the gap between the two cars she hadn't tagged and was able to stick a tracker in the rear well of one and the front of the other. She looked up and down the road and confirmed she hadn't missed any of the cruisers. Of course, there were ones out on patrol, but she could take care of them later if necessary. She headed back to her car, task one accomplished. 12 minutes later, she was driving into the hills east of Bradbury. Here, homes were scattered between large open fields and copses of pines. At Merrick Road, she turned again and started checking address numbers on mailboxes, finally locating the one she was looking for a mile and a half in. She continued down the road a few hundred yards until she found a grass-covered road, if you could call it that, that passed between two fields and disappeared into a copse of pines. After hiding the Mustang, she grabbed a handful of easy-track eavesdroppers, combination bugs that could both track and listen in on conversations, hopped out of the car and moved into the woods. Officer Harris's house sat at the end of a 100-foot driveway, surrounded by a well-manicured lawn. The exterior of the house was gray stone on the lower third and dark red-stained wood on the rest. Parked in front was a Ford C-Max hybrid hatchback. That was unexpected.
Ananka had guessed Harris drove a truck, or at the very least, a muscle car. She knew that was stereotyping, but that was the vibe the cop had given her. Maybe the car wasn't Harris's. Could belong to a friend or a roommate. Ananka moved as close as she could get without leaving the woods. Though no lights were on that she could see inside the house, there was enough sunlight for her to identify the kitchen and the living room through the windows along the back. Both appeared to be deserted, just as she'd hoped. Harris worked the graveyard shift and probably didn't come home until close to 7 a.m., and it was likely she hadn't gone to sleep right away. Even in a small town like Bradbury, a job like Harris's would require some winding down time. Since it was barely past 1 p.m., Harris had probably been asleep for only 5 hours at most. If Ananka had the woman's job, she wouldn't open her eyes until 3 or 4 in the afternoon. She figured she had at least another hour before Harris woke. She checked the yard for signs of a dog. No toys scattered about, no doghouse. On top of that, the lawn was a uniform green. A dog would have turned areas brown from repeated urination. Unless, of course, the dog was trained to go out into the woods. She used her binoculars to scrutinize the house. No cameras, just several floodlights with motion detectors that would be a problem only at night. Deciding the risk was worth it, she crept out of the woods and across the lawn. No barks, no sound of running paws. When she reached the house, she peeked through the nearest window into the living room. As she suspected, it was currently unoccupied. She turned her ear to the glass. Quiet. She moved along the side of the house and up to the front corner, from where she scanned the front yard and driveway. The C-Max was the only car in sight, and there was no garage. Well, there was, but it had been converted into a room, the door replaced by a wall and small window. She padded over to the car and peeked inside. A police hat sat in the passenger seat. Seriously? This was Harris's ride? That kind of pissed off Ananka. She hated that, A, she was wrong, and B, she'd pigeonholed the woman in the first place. Stay on task, she reminded herself. Suppressing her annoyance, she stuck a bug against the lower front corner of the windshield where it could use the window as an amplifier, but would be out of sight and out of the way of the wipers. She returned to the house, placing bugs in spots where she was sure Harris wouldn't look anytime soon. She was at the back, placing a bug on the frame of the kitchen window where it would blend in when the curtain on the other side of the glass shook. She dropped below the window frame a beat before the curtain swung open. From inside, she heard someone moving around, Harris, presumably. When there was no shout of surprise, or worse, a get-on-your-knees-hands-on-your-head order, Ananka eased along the wall to the chimney. The big problem? All retreats to the woods were in view of a window. The moment the cop spotted Ananka, she'd recognize her. There weren't that many tall African-American women hanging around Bradbury, after all. As Ananka contemplated her non-existent options, the sliding glass door at the back of the living room opened. She pressed against the wall. If not for the protruding fireplace between them, she would have been in plain sight. And that advantage would disappear if Harris took more than a couple of steps outside. Ananka slipped quickly to the corner of the house and swung around it. There, she allowed herself a quick, relieved breath before pulling out her phone and a gooseneck camera she'd picked up when she'd grabbed the bugs. She attached the plug side to her phone and eased the camera end around the corner. At first, everything appeared as it had before. The small back deck, the empty green yard, and the not-too-distant forest in the background. Then Harris stepped away from the house. She wore a pair of gym shorts and a sports bra and held a coffee mug that had steam rising from it. There was no denying it. Officer Harris was in great shape. With abs like hers, she must do a million. Ananka didn't realize Harris was turning in her direction until too late. Her animal instinct was to pull the camera back and take off running, but years of experience kicked in, and she kept it still, knowing jerking it away would make it more visible. Harris's gaze swept along the side of the house and turned out toward the woods as she lifted her cup and took a drink. Half a minute later, she sauntered back inside. When Ananka heard the strong, steady flow of a shower from the other side of the bathroom window, she hightailed it back to the trees. After reaching the Mustang, she sat behind the wheel for a few moments, catching her breath. She was even more confused about Harris now than she'd been before. The woman wasn't fitting neatly into the box Ananka had begun to build for her. Her phone buzzed with a text from the administrator. 2 additional party invites secured.
13.
I'm telling you, we gotta get in there and take a look,
Ricky said,
not wanting to chance exposure from a second in-person team meeting so soon after the first. Ananka had everyone on video group chat so they could fill one another in on what they'd discovered. Ricky had told them about